Welcome. This is the Intimacy Podcast. Here, you'll find clean sex talk, practical advice to take your relationship to the next level, and answers to your intimate questions. I'm your host, certified intimacy coach and instructor, Rhonda Farr. While this podcast is not rated explicit, some content may not be suitable for younger listeners. Hey, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Intimacy Podcast. Today, you're going to be hearing a discussion between myself and Dr. Cameron Staley. We're talking about those who are struggling with patterns of pornography use, and in particular, how to empower those individuals. I think you're going to find that this is a different discussion about a familiar topic, so I hope you enjoy. I will not spend a lot of time on this intro so we can get right into the meat of the interview today, but I did want to say, if you're not a member of my religious community, this one might not make a lot of sense to you, or if you don't come from a very conservative religious background. Today we're speaking to those who have a moral dilemma with viewing pornography, and they struggle to overcome that habit or pattern of behavior. So if that doesn't sound like something that you find important or value, this might not be the episode for you. Please enjoy. All right. Welcome, Dr. Cameron Staley, to the podcast today. So excited that you are sharing your time with me. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself to my listeners who may not have heard of you before?
Sure, yeah. I'm a clinical psychologist, did my graduate work at Idaho State University, and then completed my year residency down at BYU at their counseling center. So I've worked at BYU's counseling center. I've been a psychologist for Idaho State and their counseling center for many years now. I also did 1 year at Utah State at their counseling center. And my research background is on sexuality. I'm specifically looking at pornography to see, really I was interested in, is it an addiction? That was kind of my research question going into it. I had a mentor who was a sex researcher and had a background in physiology. So we were able to look at kind of brain activity using EEG technology just to see if the brain patterns of people who were struggling with porn resembled those who are addicted to drugs. So that was kind of my background with researching pornography. But working in Intermountain West in Utah and Idaho, I work with a lot of people coming in with pornography concerns. So I spent a lot of time over the years trying to understand that better and find better ways to help people who've been struggling for years and years with this problem. So I never set out to be like an expert with pornography. I'm really a generalist. I don't specialize in any one thing. But I have really committed to whoever walks in my door, I should learn to meet their needs, be it an eating disorder, to depression, to psychosis, to compulsive behaviors, to pornography. So since I worked with a lot of pornography in this area, I had to become more proficient. So yeah, it's kind of happenstance. That's been an area where I've spent a lot more time with.
Love it. Yeah, not many people set out in the hopes of being a pornography specialist, I'm guessing.
No.
But your research and your study has proven to be quite beneficial for those you serve. And in fact, I'm going to go ahead and bring this up now. You have a program that you've developed through your years of experience and research that is proving quite successful for many people. Do you want to tell me just a little bit about that before we get into our discussion today?
Yeah, I think as I was searching for better ways to help people with pornography, I think some of the prevailing approaches out there were based on addictions, 12-step recovery, and that's all I heard about, all I knew. And when I looked at the research, I really couldn't find any kind of treatment outcome studies showing the effectiveness of addiction approaches. But I did find that acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, was the only one that had published research. And it was really effective. But I didn't know a ton about ACT. I was trained using a lot of cognitive behavioral techniques. But when I went to BYU, I was surprised to discover they'd been using ACT in that center for a really long time. And they had been offering groups for sexual concerns, specifically pornography and masturbation, using an ACT model for about 15 years, probably closer to 20 years at this point. That was really my first time getting to use ACT, getting to know how it works. And it was really helpful for the students on that campus. And so I continued to use ACT in my work. And one of the last groups that I ran for pornography, the members kind of turned the table on me and challenged me to do more. And said if they would have learned these principles earlier, they could have got help a lot sooner. And they said, why is this not online? Why is this not available? And so I took their challenge to heart and said, yeah, I've asked you to take some risks in your life. Maybe I should try to make this available. So what I did is created a 10-module series, which basically walks people through what I would do with somebody that I was working with in counseling following that same ACT framework. Mm-hmm. So it's a self-directed online approach and where you can do it in your own home, on your mobile, wherever you're at. And I tried to make it less than the cost of a single therapy session. I thought these principles have been so helpful. It's the only approach I've found that has scientific support. And I thought, I got to do more. I got to make this more accessible to people. So I hope it's a good start. I think a lot of people may need more than just a self-directed program. They may need more personal kind of one-on-one counseling. But for a lot of people, I think if they had access to the principles, that they could get a lot of help on their own. So why wait around? Why make it expensive? Let's make it as easy as we can. So that's kind of the background behind Life After Pornography. That's the website we put together. I also wrote a couple short ebooks that I just wrote for free just to help kind of teach some of the principles so people can get started. If you're not so sure about it, it's like, yep, check out some of the free materials. We're even launching a podcast pretty soon, just to share more principles to help people. I think that's my ultimate goal is there's a lot of really good things that are helpful. People just aren't aware of it.
Love it. So what we're going to do for the listeners who are interested, we'll leave a link to Life After Pornography in the podcast episode details so they can find that. And for those who aren't sure, ACT is acceptance commitment therapy, right?
Yep, acceptance and commitment therapy.
We are not going to go into that deeply today, but go look that up. And I think they'll get the gist of it based on our conversation, the gist of what that means. So I want to start out by asking a little bit about the word addiction. You and I kind of talked offline a little bit, and we talked about how I think some people are afraid to let go of the word addiction. And I want to address that a little bit. And here, let me break it down after I give you a few different ideas of what I'm talking about. We think that the church uses addiction, and so we're afraid to go against what the church says. That's one thing. Also, if we don't label ourselves as an addict, I think sometimes we're afraid that we won't hold ourselves accountable, or it's like we're not taking it serious enough, or maybe that we're condoning the behavior of patterns of pornography. So let's address those concerns and tell me what you think about the word addiction in relation to those.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I think the word addiction is such a loaded and powerful word. Like there's so much meaning we have associated. I think there's a lot of fear associated with it. And one thing I've been surprised with is every time I kind of talk or write some things about pornography concerns, the strongest reactions I get from folks is how I talk about addiction. There is such a belief system around addiction. So anything even close to that, I think feels really threatening for a lot of people. And I think I appreciate the addiction movement maybe more than I talk about generally. I think about people struggling with substance use. Often a lot of their needs weren't being met. So people from churches and organizations came in and said, we need to do something to fill this void. And these are people struggling themselves that really said, this is a moral concern. We need to do something here. And they created a framework. And I think addiction programs have been really helpful for many people over the years. But they're not based on psychological theory. There's not a lot of science behind them. Even for substance use, there's a lot more effective treatments than addiction approaches. But they've really filled the need for a long time. I think that word addiction is just all we've known. Mm-hmm. It's how we talk about it. And I'm with you when you hear kind of leaders in our church talk about pornography as an addiction. I kind of like, well, yeah, the prophet has spoken. That's just what it is. We got to use that same term. The challenge is, as I've worked with people over the years, I just haven't found that language to be very helpful in helping them move forward. And sometimes it feels like half of the battle. Like, even though they're struggling with pornography, that kind of fixation on being labeled an addict or this is an addiction feels like a lot of our work's about kind of loosening the hold that word has almost become part of their identity have on them.
Yeah. So when I work with my clients, I'm always asking them, when you have a thought or a belief about yourself or somebody else or something in the world, I challenge them to really understand if that serves them well. Does that fuel you to become the best version of yourself? And I suppose if somebody's labeled an addict and that feels empowering to them, I don't know how it could, but if it makes them feel empowered, I suppose it could serve them, right? But what I find is for many people, when they figure out that they actually do have choices and the capability of changing and becoming whoever they want to be, that's when they actually feel empowered to change, and their actions are so very different when they feel that way.
Absolutely. And I've seen that. There's been a couple times where someone labeling themselves an addict was kind of the motivation they needed to seek help. Where it's like, okay, this is a problem. I can't do it on my own. This is legitimate. I need to get help. I'm an addict. And it gets them in the door where it's like, great, that term was helpful for you. But then to actually get into the therapy work, yeah, it seems like it causes more barriers because I'm with you. If it's serving you, use it. Like, I think a lot of people use addiction, like I'm addicted to my phone or gaming or food. And I understand what they're saying. And so I don't like correct people. Like, I don't think that's an addiction. Like, I don't even do that. I don't really have a debate like that when I'm working with somebody. I'm the same as you. It's like, let's understand how you're using that word. And if it's helpful, let's use it. If it's not, let's talk about other ways just to describe what's going on. I think we use addiction as a shortcut. And this may seem strange, but I've thought about this with addiction and pornography. Those words at times can be a euphemism where it's a lot easier to say, oh, I'm addicted to porn than, wow, I struggle with watching naked people having sex.
Yeah.
Like, wow, that's actually what you're doing. That can feel really aversive to say. Even though you don't want to say you're a porn addict, sometimes it's easier to say that than, actually, I watch naked people having sex. And so for me, I try to remove any evaluations and judgments and actually just to describe what actually is going on. And sometimes doing that, just removing the word pornography or addiction, just describing the actual act is really helpful in empowering that person. Is this something you want to choose to do? Do you want to watch naked people having sex for the next 20 minutes or the next hour or this afternoon? I mean, that's really helpful in letting people make choice. I think agency is such an eternal principle and so special. And sometimes I found believing you're addicted diminishes your ability to act. And for me, that hasn't been helpful in promoting change.
Yeah, I see that all the time in the work I do. When you feel like you are not in control anymore, that you don't have choices, that's when you kind of just roll over and take it, right? You just stay where you're at. Before we move past this, my question is, the church does use the addiction recovery program, right? That's something that we do. And you and I both think that there's a purpose, and we're definitely not saying anything against the church. But it's interesting to me that in the work you did on BYU campus, when they are helping people overcome pornography addiction, they do not use the addiction model. I'm puzzled by that.
Yeah, and I don't have all the answers to that. And honestly, I was pretty surprised too when I left my graduate program and went to BYU. I kind of had the assumption that they would be using addiction programs. And when I got there, I mean, they have a pretty large counseling center, and they're mostly psychologists that are trained like me, that they're scientists and practitioners. So they know the research, they know psychological theory. There's ethical standards where you have to deliver treatments that are evidence-based. So they're kind of operating in that framework. And the counseling center there is pretty independent, that they're able to help students by delivering the most appropriate, effective treatments possible, which is amazing. That counseling center is doing wonderful things. But yeah, they've been doing ACT for a long time because it's the only approach I found with any research, but it's also really effective. Mm-hmm. And I think about, if we zoom out to the church in general, I think the addiction recovery program filled a need where you don't have to be a mental health clinician to kind of facilitate that program. You can be a volunteer. You can help facilitate a group. I think people get a lot of benefit from the support, the structure. So I think it's a way to help a lot of people really efficiently. But it's not mental health therapy. It's not based on psychological theory. It's really not a treatment. So I've worked with a lot of folks where they've gone through addiction recovery program and it hasn't been helpful for them. And others where they have gone through and it has been helpful. So for me, that's my next question, same thing with the addiction. It's like, if you're doing the ARP, if it's helpful, fantastic, keep going.
Yeah.
And if it's not helpful, let's try something different. So I'm not sure. I think there is a shift I've felt within the church. I know within the last year, the church produced some new videos on pornography, and I watched every single one. And I listened really carefully. I didn't hear them use the word addiction a single time. So I think they're starting to move away from that. I know Elder Oaks, he gave a talk a couple of years back about different levels of involvement or engagement, not all of it's addiction. I thought that was really helpful and really eye-opening to a lot of people. So I think there's a movement. I'm not sure exactly why acceptance commitment therapy isn't adopted church-wide, other than to be able to deliver it, you have to be a licensed mental health professional and have some training in ACT, and that might slow down the delivery of it. But yeah, that's probably my thoughts on it. But yeah, it was interesting to learn that they were using ACT at BYU, not addiction recovery.
And success rates were pretty high.
It's huge. Like, we work on a semester basis, so we have 10 or 12 weeks with folks, and the research that was published actually out of Utah State found that within 12 sessions of ACT, they found over a 90% reduction in viewing on average. It's incredible.
Incredible.
It's amazing. I think about, like, why is that not well known everywhere? That's huge. Like, you know, that kind of symptom reduction with depression or anxiety or trauma or OCD, like, that would make headlines. And it doesn't, because I think people were so ingrained in addiction. Even it's like, this might work even better. It's like, but you're not using addiction language. Well, I'm just interested in finding what's helpful. And right now, ACT, in my experience, seems to be the most effective way.
I love it. I love that you're open-minded. For some people, maybe the addiction model works, a few people, right? And maybe... Yep. Even for a period of time, it works for more people, right? Getting them in the door. I love how you acknowledge that maybe there is value somewhere for some people. But the success rates that we're seeing when we turn to ACT, it's just unparalleled, it seems like.
Yeah.
So let's switch gears here. If it's not addiction for everybody, if for most people it seems like it's not actually an addiction based on your research and your studying, what's going on then? Let's describe to the listeners what's actually happening.
Yeah, I think I have a general way I think about it. And then I think there's some unique presentations that I've seen over the years with folks. But my research, when we were looking at, is there a neurological pathway similar to substance use? We didn't find that. But what we did find was people had a harder time controlling their viewing of porn, also experienced the highest levels of distress, anxiety, guilt, any negative emotions while viewing pornography. And so that role of emotions is central in compulsive disorders. So I think about, like, whenever you experience any negative mood state from sadness or loneliness or anxiety, often we try to engage in a behavior to alleviate that. And so we can accomplish that by eating, scrolling through our phone, shopping, using drugs or alcohol, or looking at sexual images. And doing that temporarily, we feel better. We escape that either by thinking about something else, or we get a bit of an endorphin rush looking at sexual images or ingesting substances. But then the cycle is, the thing that we engage in to help us feel better, we then feel guilty about, because it's inconsistent with our morals, our beliefs, or our health. And then that brings up the negative emotions again. So it's like, okay, I feel bad again. I know how to take care of that. I'm going to engage in that eating, looking at sexual images, drinking. And it's like that feels better again temporarily.
Yeah.
And then the guilt and the shame comes up. So that's the cycle. So I clearly see that emotion cycle. I think about it, for me, a compulsion model seems to fit a little bit better. And so if we think about like obsessions and compulsions, some people that grew up not having a lot of comfort around sexuality or words or language, when they feel arousal or desire, it's actually uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's so sinful. And so one way to get rid of that discomfort is like, I'm going to look at porn and masturbate as quickly as I can to get rid of that. And then it brings up that shame and guilt again. So I definitely see that cycle happening over and over. And I'm seeing that more in the literature. And there's a classification system for mental health diagnoses called the ICD. I think we're at volume 10 or 11 now. And they actually just added compulsive sexual disorder in that volume. They don't have sex addiction, but they added the compulsive one. And I'm actually a support of that. I think that's a pretty good move. The thing that conceptualized most people in kind of a general sense, because it does follow that compulsive pattern. And I think while it doesn't get a lot of traction with folks is they want to say, no, the reason why people are struggling, there's something biological, neurological going on. And when I say, no, I think it's emotions, people say, well, you're not thinking it's serious enough. And I think about like, emotions are so powerful. They organize us. They organize our actions. Like saying, I think emotions are underlying this, for me, legitimizes this mm-hmm. concern. But people want to think like, that's got to be something bigger than that. It's like, it doesn't. Emotions are real. They're powerful.
I want to speak to something and get your view on this. We hear all the time, watching pornography can rewire the brain. So you and I know that these neurological pathways, these neural pathways are just connections, right? The brain is meant to be efficient. And I actually think pornography can rewire your brain, but I also think eating a little Debbie cake can rewire your brain. And I think moving homes to a new home, so you drive home without thinking about it anymore, rewires your brain.
Yep.
So when I hear people say, oh, pornography rewires your brain, I'm like, yep. And so does learning how to ride a bike. And so does learning how to type on a keyboard. What we're saying is when something happens, your brain goes so quickly to the next behavior that you don't even have to think about it anymore.
Yep.
And what I hear you saying is when we feel stress, when we feel anxiety or boredom, right? Even if it's not a huge emotion, maybe we're just bored. Our brain learns over time, go quickly to this action, get this physiological release, whatever, and it will take care of that. So we just learn to do it without even thinking. And I think that's where the addiction comes in. People are like, well, I've tried to stop and I can't. But it's because you don't have awareness around what's going on. Yeah?
Yeah, that's 100%. And it seems so simple. I think we try to overcomplicate things and bring some mysticism to it. But it's just that. Like, we found something that works. And so your mind's going to turn to that quicker. So it automates the process. It's the same thing with driving. The first time we learn to drive, it's kind of cumbersome and it takes a lot of effort. It becomes over automatic. So we've rewired the brain. That's just how brain activity works. And so another way I think about things like pornography or drugs or eating is they're rewards.
Yes.
And rewards are reinforcing. We tend to do those again and again. And that's just a really simple process. So drugs are like that. Sexual images are like that. Food. For me, basketball is very rewarding. Exercise can be that. Those are all operating on that dopaminergic pathway.
Yes.
They're just reinforcing. I don't think there's things that are too unique about those. They're all reinforcing. They all become more automated. They're all things that we're programmed to like. They just become more automatic with practice, with repetition.
And you think about when you're eating a food, you eat a carrot, and that does give you a little bit of a dopamine hit, right? Because as a human, we're hardwired to seek pleasure, eat foods, right? Like, it's within us. When you eat a little Debbie cake or whatever your processed fatty, salty food is,
like it's a bigger hit, right?
Bigger.
And so it creates that reward that's a little bit bigger. And when I think about humans, right, like sexual desire is human nature. That's what keeps the species going. And I think about in the way that food, like processed food is a concentrated hit, right?
Yep.
Pornography is a concentrated hit of sexual reward, right? So it's like the carrot to the little Debbie cake equals actual sex with a partner, that your husband or wife, and looking at pornography. It's just concentrated sexual pleasure, in my opinion. So it's a bigger hit, right? And it's more in your control when you're looking at pornography. Like, you call the shots and it's not as awkward. You don't have to be vulnerable. Like, it's so much more, it just feels easier to our brain, even though it's so much less fulfilling. And we beat ourselves up and then we have shame and then we feel anxiety and then we have to do it again to cope with that.
Yeah.
But we're not thinking about that in those terms, right? When we're engaged in the behavior in the cycle.
Yep. It's so fun to listen to you talk, because, like, the first time we met is right now. We're chatting now and talking, and you're across the country, and it's like, that's exactly the same thing I've experienced with people, is pornography is a packaged Little Debbie. It's a concentrated hit. But for me, it's empty calories, but it's a really safe way to get that. It doesn't require any vulnerability. There's no risk to it. The actors you're viewing are not going to reject you. It's too safe. But it gives you a little bit of that where it's like, yeah, that tasted good. But for me, it's not the real thing. It's not intimacy with a partner. It's not true connection. For me, you don't get any sexual education from pornography. That's not the goal. It's a little Debbie where it's like, yeah, it might feel good in that moment. It's not going to help you feel better. It's not going to get you towards your goals. But yeah, it feels good in that moment. But I think we skip past all that. And when I work with folks, I ask them, like, what do you get out of viewing porn? And often, like, nothing. It's terrible. I hate it. It's like, no, we do things for a reason. There's a reinforcement. Like, what are you getting out of it? And as they actually slow down to think about it, it's like, I guess I've been overwhelmed and stressed, and I feel a little better. It's like, yeah, or I haven't talked to anybody, and that gave me a little bit of connection with another human, which that might sound strange if you haven't struggled with porn, but for some people that don't have a lot of human connection or strong relationships, pornography gives you a little bit of it. I don't think it's sustainable, and it's not the real connection we're shooting for. But for some people, it's more than none. And they're getting things out of that. But I think we're so programmed to, like, no, porn is just terrible. You can't actually look at maybe what's maintaining that behavior. And when we slow down and look at it, we can start to empower that person again. But we have to step back from that fear of this is a terrible thing to actually, let's understand what's happening for you.
Thank you for bringing that up. Stepping back and, first of all, gaining that awareness of what's happening. I think that's the first step to any change, understanding what's really going on, which is why sometimes I think the addiction model doesn't work. Because if this really is, in most cases, maybe not all cases, but in most cases, about managing the emotions that we don't like to feel, we need to know that or we can't change it. So I love that. But then the other piece of this, you're like, you know, we kind of demonize it. I think we also kind of demonize the people who are doing it, especially if it's our spouse or, you know, maybe even with our kids. We don't demonize our kids, but we demonize that this has gotten hold on them, right? And we just, but I've heard you say before, because I've listened to your podcasts and TED Talks and read some articles about your work, that sometimes these are the most sensitive, most well-intended, striving to be righteous people you've ever met. Speak more about that.
Yeah, I think my first experience working with people was at BYU, and I knew that's a religious institution. There's a lot of Latter-day Saint members there, and so I was working with people with a lot of different concerns, and then I worked with the folks that struggle with pornography, and it's like, wow, these seemed on average to be the ones that were working really hard, striving to keep the commandments, to be honest with other people. They tended to be a little more sensitive, very thoughtful, kind-hearted people. They knew their scriptures inside and out. They're quoting conference talks. And it's like, I'm seeing a consistent pattern here. where maybe having some of those traits might put you in a more vulnerable position to struggling with pornography. So I also found with these individuals, they were often came from homes where sex education was absent. Sexuality was not an open conversation. And these individuals, often their awareness of emotions was lower than most people. So when people come in for counseling, we have them fill out a survey, just kind of rating things they're struggling with and distress. And routinely, we would get people rating really, really low. And I would just see that questioner, I'm like, I bet it's pornography. Their awareness of emotions was really low. And I don't know if that's kind of how it was for them to begin with, or if just viewing porn over the years continued to turn that volume switch down on emotions or numb that out. That awareness of what are you feeling in this moment was very minimal. So I saw those consistent patterns, but for the most part, these were really good people. And what broke my heart over and over is they felt like they were the worst person on the planet because they believed the same thing that we were taught, that pornography is a really terrible, bad, evil thing. If I'm engaging in that, that must make me a really bad, terrible, evil person. And that wasn't my experience with them. And as I saw that over and over, it's like, oh my gosh, somebody has to defend you from you. Like, they hated themselves, the level of self-loathing and hatred and fear. And then they would withdraw from other people where it's like, I don't want to date. I don't want to contaminate people. I don't want to hurt anybody. And I was told this was going to progress and get worse. And I don't want to hurt anybody. And
then I'm going to be a child molester or whatever else. I'm going to, yeah, exactly.
You name it. And it broke my heart. It's like, well, you're probably the safest person I've met today because of their awareness. And like, I just want to do good. And that maybe put at more risk for how these messages have hit them.
I think, to speak to what you're saying, I think that it puts them at more risk for staying stuck in the patterns of behavior too, right? Because I'm a horrible, terrible person. I'm feeling tons of shame. I'm feeling tons of anxiety about this evil thing that I'm engaging in. What happens when you feel that way? You isolate. You have to manage those feelings somehow, right? The stress and all that you're feeling. And that strong neural pathway says, when you feel this way, you look at pornography, right? And this is how you feel better. That's your dopamine hit that you need to chill and calm down. So I think really you're beating yourself up and you're feeling a terrible person. You're feeling terrible about the pornography use. You repeat the cycle. You're actually sabotaging yourself unknowingly. Yep. You are causing the issue without knowing it. And it looks beautiful. This is the thing. It looks very lovely to despise pornography. It looks very worthy of you to think you're an awful person for engaging in it. It sounds really lovely that you're doing those things, but what you're actually doing is keeping yourself stuck.
Yep. And I think that's the difficult balance is how can you say, yeah, pornography is something I don't want to do. I don't agree with the industry. How do you raise awareness and talk about it without further perpetuating that?
Can you speak to that? I think that is something we're afraid of. So many people, like I said in the beginning, who are afraid of removing the word addiction, I think exactly what you said is their dilemma. So say more about that.
I think that's the challenge. And so there's been a few states, I think Utah was the first one, that has passed legislation that this is an epidemic. This is a public health crisis. And part of me is like, yeah, let's raise awareness. Like, let's improve education. I don't think youth should be exposed to pornography. That doesn't teach them any healthy sexuality. And there's a lot of unrealistic things that are portrayed. I don't think youth can cope with those types of images. It's just not helpful. So I want to promote awareness. But then when we use terms like epidemic and a crisis, those that are currently struggling with pornography, it contributes to more of those struggles. And many times I would work with folks that, I mean, they'd be doing pretty good with their porn for a while, and then they hear a church talk about the evils of pornography again. And it's like, they actually go backwards, and they struggle more for a little while. And so there's that fine line of we've got to talk about it because this is important. Sexuality is sacred. Procreation is so sacred. And having sex in the bounds of marriage is such an intimacy-building experience that we do need to still teach that. We still need to practice that and advocate for that, but but also recognize as we're learning about anything in life, we're going to make mistakes. There's going to be challenges along the way. And if we over focus on those mistakes, it doesn't help people learn. So I think about learning about sexuality, like learning how to ride a bike. And I crashed a lot. I ride a bike now and still crash. Every year I still have a really good crash. And if you were crashing as a kid or an adolescent or even an adult and people said, how dare you crash? Like, how do you not have this figured out by now? And I think about how powerful sexual drive is, and yet there's no ability to learn or make mistakes or even have a coach. Like, my dad helped hold the back of my bicycle seat as I was wobbling down the driveway. Like, I had people supporting me and giving me like tips, like, hey, like, slow down around this curve, or this is what brakes are for. But with sexuality, it's like, this drive is so powerful, good luck with it, you're on your own. So we're setting people up to fail and then blaming them for it. Yeah. And I struggle with that pattern where it's like, with more education and openness, I think we'd see a dramatic reduction in pornography viewing concerns.
I love that. I agree with you wholeheartedly. When we're able to talk about it with our youth, when we're able to talk about it with the couple who's struggling with the pain and hurt of their patterns, right? When we're able to just embrace those people and say, listen, we see you. We know you're struggling. We don't think that you should continue down these patterns, but also we know there are answers and solutions, and we're here and able to help you. You know, think about some terrible disease, right? You could get up and speak about an epidemic in that way, and fear-mongering keeps everybody in their house. They never go out. Yes. We don't find solutions. We don't do the things. Or you can say, hey, just so you know, this is what might be happening. We have ways to handle it and combat it. We want to equip you with those. Yeah, it's serious. Yeah, it's a big deal. And we also have your back. Come to us for help. I just think it's such a different experience in the way we handle it and the way we approach it.
And that makes all the difference. I think about neurologically, our amygdala is that emotion center, that fear center. And so when we use that those fear approach, that just keeps us on high alert. And we do things to cope with that. And that's where the more porn viewing comes. But if we took that approach that you shared, like, hey, this is important. Let's talk about it. There are solutions. There's hope. That amygdala part of our brain kind of quiets down, and our frontal lobe comes back online, which is our decision-making process. It's our thinking. It's our impulse control. It's how we manage emotions. And we're only really able to access that when that fear center quiets down. But so much of the language around pornography activates the fear center. That just interferes with people regulating impulses and managing urges and regulating emotions.
Well, when we get afraid, we get stressed, right? And what do we do when we get stressed if that's our neural pathway?
You got it.
We look at more porn.
That's what happens. Yeah.
So on my podcast, when I can, I like to give people some real tips on how to manage what we're talking about. So for us in today's conversation, what we're saying is start getting aware of your emotions. If somebody out here listening is struggling with pornography, start getting aware of that. When you feel that urge, take a moment and look inward. This is what I tell my clients. Look inward. What am I feeling right now?
Yeah.
Name that emotion. Where do I feel it in my body? Is it heavy? Is it light? Is it fast? Is it slow? Because some people have a hard time feeling emotions. And if we can really get in depth with describing it, it's easier for them to call it out the next time. So for those listening, I would say, number one, just start being aware of what you're feeling when you're engaging in behavior that you would rather not. What would you say?
You took the words right from me. You stole my thunder. And I think we want something grand. Like, for me, the comparison is Naaman in the Old Testament, where he has leprosy. And he's like, call for the prophet. And the prophet sent his servant and says, you know, go dip in the river seven times. He's like, well, I'm not going to do that. Well, if you were asked to do some grand thing, you would have done that. He's like, oh, you're right. So for me, like, what are you feeling? Is that just go dip in the river thing?
Yeah.
It seems so simple. We don't want to do it. But that's it. And what I've seen when I've done that, just that, I'll ask people, say, I don't want you to do anything different in relation to pornography this week. Don't try to control anything. Don't count it. I just want you to notice what you're feeling. And what they discover, and it's a discovery every time, where it's like, I was actually feeling an emotion prior to having an urge to view porn. It's like, yes, an emotion is going to precede that trigger or urge to view. And it is stress. It's feeling overwhelmed. It's sadness. It's loneliness. And for many folks, it's boredom. Like you mentioned, it's not a huge emotion, but if we're not aware of this, I'm feeling bored. We do things to get away from that. And it's automatic because we've already kind of taught our mind and our body where to go. And it's like, let's just slow down and let's feel what's there. And I'm with you. People that struggle with porn are often so much in their head, in their thoughts, planning, moving on to the next thing. We got to look at where is it in your body?
Mm-hmm.
As we settle down and get present with what's going on, often that urge to view porn goes away. Because really, we just condition ourselves that we're feeling something. Let's just ramp up the sexual arousal and not feel any of those subtle emotions. Yeah. But increasing awareness is most of it. Just people are like, no, that's too simple. Give me the big things. And it's like, that's honestly most of it. And why ACT is so effective is ACT is a mindfulness-based approach. And with mindfulness, it's we're going to slow down. We're going to take stock of what you're thinking, what you're feeling, where you are in your body. And when I'm doing this with clients, like, how is this going to help me fix pornography? And it's like, tell your mind to take a break. Let's actually cultivate some awareness. And cultivating that is the key to overcoming pornography.
And I think why this works so well is because when we have an emotion in our body and we try to resist feeling it, it doesn't actually go away. I call it buffering. Like we're buffering so we don't feel it, but it's still there. And so it keeps surfacing. This book by Emily Nagoski, it's called Come As You Are, and it's about sexuality. But she talks about how emotions are like tunnels. And the way we actually get past an emotion is to travel through it. We pass through it, and then it loses its power over us. So I teach my clients, an emotion is a vibration in your body. Your brain has a thought, and it sends a signal out, and it's just an uncomfortable vibration when you're feeling anxiety or boredom or nervousness or stress. You can handle an uncomfortable vibration if you know what you're doing, right? If we teach you how, you can breathe into it, you can accept it, you can feel it, you can pass through that and manage it. Versus if you're buffering and continuing to resist and push it away, it's still there. You never manage it.
Yep.
So, and it's not to say if you travel through that emotion, it will never resurface. Of course, we feel stress based on different things, and that's okay. But what my clients are finding, by the way, I don't work with tons of pornography clients. I just work with a lot of men and women who want to react and lash out at their husbands instead of feel what they're feeling. They want to act it out. But what my clients find is once they do that a few times, they're like, oh, I can do that. And they get better at it and better at it until it's like not even that big of a deal anymore. Okay, disappointment. I can do disappointment. And they're fine.
Yep. And then that becomes automatic. So I'm with you. What I do for the most part when people come in for mental health therapy is what I'm going to do is create a safe environment to slow you down so you can feel what's there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's most of what I do. And there's times I teach techniques and do some skill building. But for the most part, you're experiencing an emotion that's trying to communicate to you in need. And
yeah.
As we continue to neglect that or buffer that, that emotion is going to keep trying to communicate to you and get louder until we listen.
Yes.
And when we listen, just like with our kids or our pets, they quiet down.
I heard somebody describe a strong emotion as like a signal, like a fire alarm. So like if a fire alarm went off in your house, you would probably look around and you would want to know what's causing it. And is there real danger here? And what room is it in? Right? Now, there are some people who would be like, frantic and run and leave their kids and their dogs and be crazy about it, right? That's probably not the best way to handle it. But I love that analogy because if we recognize a strong emotion just as a signal, like you were saying, it's kind of like an alarm saying, hey, check this out. That's where we say, where's this coming from? What am I thinking right now? Why am I feeling this? And we just notice like something's going on. For example, I'm going to throw myself under the bus. So yesterday, I knew I had this interview with you coming up, And I got word that my kids' schools were canceled because of so many flu cases. And then my power was scheduled for a routine outage for some work for 7 hours today when I had client calls, four kids home, all the things. So last night I thought, I'm just going to rest and I'm going to watch a little show and go to sleep early. What kept happening was my chest was getting tight and I could feel, it was almost like my phone was like crawling to my hand or my hand was being pulled to my phone.
Yeah.
Do you know why? I know you know why. Because there's this neural pathway in my brain that says, grab your phone, feel that dopamine hit, and check out. So even me, I know what's going on. I feel this happening. Before I learned this, I used to think that I was addicted to my phone. I thought there was something wrong with me. I thought, my phone has ruined me. I am broken. I thought, I have attention deficit disorder now because of my phone. That's what I thought. But what I now know is when I feel stressed out, it provides a dopamine hit and it calms me down. And that's why I feel like a physical pull from my hand to the phone. So it's not just pornography. Like emotions do that to us.
Yep. I like that you bring that example up because I think that is such a perfect comparison. And maybe one that's easier for people to hear that they can relate to. Because I'm with you. I feel that same impulse to check my messages, check my emails. But that impulse is stronger when I'm stressed.
Yes.
And it seems so automatic and reflexive. And I remember I was leading a lecture that I was giving and immediately I pull out my phone. And I'm like, you know, just because you have the urge to check your phone doesn't mean you have to do it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess I could practice what I preach. I could notice that urge and let it pass and keep my phone in my pocket and just enjoy my walk and collect my thoughts and reflect on that abnormal psychology class that I just taught. And it's the same thing with pornography, but I think what makes a difference is we get more scared and there's less comfort around talking about porn than there is talking about scrolling through social media. But I think the function is pretty much the same.
Yeah.
And I think we could relate to that. So when we have a partner that's struggling with pornography, we may not relate to that struggle or like, that's a terrible thing, but we're probably doing the same thing just in a different area. Finding how we relate is going to help you get closer to your partner, but also help your partner kind of settle down too. So finding those points of connection is key and not saying you got to fix that thing. It's like, no, we all do this just in different ways. You found porn, you found your phone, you found food, you found exercising. We're all doing this. Let's understand it and support each other.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, isn't it? Uchtdorf, who said, don't judge me because I sin differently than you.
So true.
There it is, right?
I feel comfortable, so I'm going to try to make you change yours first. But it's like, yeah, we just are doing it different. I think about like true ministering is just supporting and helping each other with the challenges we have. And I think the struggles we're given draw us to each other. So having pornography doesn't have to be a terrible thing. It might be the thing that's going to draw you closer to your family or to your partner. It's going to compel you to say, and I need help. I need to talk about things. This isn't going well. So you might not like the thing you're struggling with, but those struggles bring us closer to Christ. They bring us closer to people in our life. That's kind of the purpose in my mind.
I love that you pointed that out because I used to think repentance was like this horrible, bad word. It meant you had done something wrong.
The punishment.
But as I got older, what I realized was repentance and the atonement is the thing that binds me to my Savior. And I realized when I come to him and say, hey, I'm not doing so well with this. I'm struggling with this. Could you help me? Or how can we work on this together? Or whatever it may be, like this give and take in that relationship. I would not have the relationship with my Savior that I have now had I not experienced that. And we can say, okay, Rhonda, that's all fine and good. I'm glad that worked out for you. But I think that's by divine design. We can read in ether, right? We were given weaknesses on purpose that we might be humble and come to him, right? We know that. And we know that he knows that we have weakness. We know that he gave them to us based on that scripture, right? Why?
Same thought when, we're studying the Book of Mormon this year and Nephi talks about Moses and like, yeah, he sent the fiery serpents and they bite people just so they'll look at the cross. And it's like, just look, like, please turn to me. And sometimes we're given things just to have us turn to him. And I think there are opportunities to grow closer. But I think the thing that it's hard to watch. It's folks that struggle with sexual concerns like pornography. I've heard this so many times where they say, I've repented so many times, God doesn't want to hear it anymore. The atonement doesn't apply to me anymore. It's like, oh, of course it does. That's what the atonement, it's infinite. That's what it's here for. And just because you watch naked people having sex doesn't disqualify the atonement. But I hear that so much where it doesn't work for me. It's like, well, of course it does. It works for all of us. So I think one of the things I struggle with pornography is I think it does mute our emotions because we're not listening to them. We're not cultivating that awareness. And for me, the more I study and reflect on myself, the spirit communicates through emotions to me. And I think that's one of the really damaging things with engaging in compulsive behaviors like pornography is we miss out on that spirit too. Not just emotions, not just connections, but those spiritual promptings. So I want people to say, to turn up that emotion volume and feel discomfort, feel anxiety. You can also feel joy and connection in the spirit. So don't run away from that by looking at porn or scrolling on your phone. It's like heaven is trying to communicate to us and we are trying to communicate. And we've got to listen even though it makes us feel uncomfortable.
Such a good point. We're muting both sides of the emotional spectrum, right? The positive and the negative. And I think when we come to talk about pornography, one of the reasons why it's so hard, and maybe perhaps why some people say, well, I can't keep coming to the Savior with this problem or whatever, there's so much stigma with pornography. If I say I eat a cupcake because I'm stressed, people are going to be like, oh, ha, 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 that's not good for you or whatever. Or if I say, yeah, I just wanted to be on my phone and veg out, people are going to be like, oh, yeah, me too, sister, all the time, right? But pornography, like it just has this completely different stigma, which does two things. It keeps you isolated and not telling people, maybe people not reaching out to you, but it also keeps you stuck in the cycle because you feel stressed and you don't reach out for help and then you do it more. And I just have to point it out, like every time when we feel those negative emotions, it keeps us in the cycle over and over.
That's what to me makes pornography unique. It's not that it might be operating us on us at a different level. It's that there's more stigma to it.
Yeah.
There's more culture attached to it. There's more associations. There's more beliefs than other things that we can talk about just more freely and liberally without fear of judgment or condemnation. Mm-hmm. I think the words we do use matter. And how we treat each other matters. And we can make a huge difference in the lives of other people just by being a little more understanding around things like pornography that make us uncomfortable.
Speaking of stigma, we're about at time. I know we've gone on for a while, so I'm going to wrap this up. I don't want to take too long. But you and I both have had women reach out to us and say, oh, yeah. I'm really struggling. This is so embarrassing. Everybody speaks to it based on man's perspective. I have young women in my stake who are struggling, right? I think parents don't know how to approach it. Leaders don't know how to approach it. They feel so ashamed because this is a man's problem. Can we speak to that just for a minute on how the women are feeling who are struggling in this area of their life?
Yeah, I think that's the group that's lost to me in this conversation. And when I'm brave enough to venture online and read people's comments and thoughts about pornography, it's so heated and there's a lot of animosity and anger towards men. And I try to imagine a woman reading those comments who's struggling with porn. And it's like, there's no way I can talk about this. It's just not safe. Like, it's not safe for men. It feels even less safe for women. Mm-hmm. I think about, and I'm sure you're doing great work with saying, like, humans are sexual beings. We have desire. That's innate. But a lot of women are kind of taught that you're not, that's not okay, that's bad, that's uncomfortable. Women or men can be sexual, but you can't. And that's not how it works. We're sexual beings, men and women. And then to think about like, oh, you're not only a sexual being, but now you're struggling with an issue that only impacts men. It's like, gosh, something must be really wrong with me on so many levels. And so when I've worked with women who have the courage to come in and say, I struggle with porn, I masturbate, I need help with this. The level of shame they feel feels double to me than the men. And so I've worked with many women over the years and they're wonderful to work with. And so helpful when I have them in a group setting with the men to be like, this isn't just a man's issue. Like women struggle with this too. But I'm trying to imagine a relief society where a woman could stand up and say, hey, I just want to let you sisters know I'm struggling with porn. want to see that day. I have a hard time imagining it. I've seen men do that sometimes in elders' corner with their buddies, like, hey, I'm struggling, can you help? But for that to happen with women, I have a hard time imagining it. But it's so needed. And I think it's like, oh, you struggle with the sexual thing. Yeah, and I think we need to carve out more space in general for pornography, but for women and these young women. You and I didn't grow up with cell phones in our hands and technology. The first time I saw pornography when I was researching it in graduate school, I didn't see this growing up as an adolescent, but kids are, men and women, or I guess boys and girls, adolescents are now. And it's not just impacting our sons, it's our daughters too. And so we've got to have those chats, even though we're uncomfortable. And we can't just keep talking about it. This is a man's issue, because that further silences the women that are struggling.
Absolutely. One of the women, her words are kind of etched in my brain. She called herself filthy, disgusting, so broken. And it just broke my heart to hear her saying those things, right? I interviewed Professor Brian Willoughby from BYU. I don't know if you're familiar with him recently, but he does a lot of research around pornography and things like that. And he actually said the statistics of those who will view pornography by the time they graduate high school are 100%.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. We have to be talking about it. We have to be not necessarily normalizing the behavior, but normalizing the urge, right? Normalizing those feelings and that draw to pornography and helping people understand that it's safe to get help and to be open. And you don't have to stand up in Relief Society if that's not your thing. I don't think you mean that we have to do that, right?
It's not but, exciting to do it, for sure.
Yeah. But reaching out for help and not feeling disgusting, filthy, yeah, horrible, like this lady said that she felt.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I've seen is when people do talk about porn, it's often like, well, those people that would struggle with it. And we need to talk about, especially when we're talking to youth, like, you know, when you come across this, a lot of people struggle with it. You can talk with us. And I've got a really good bishop who just kind of normalizes that struggle and is just so down to earth and just says, yeah, if you're struggling, just come talk. And he's thoughtful. And I had a backyard chat with him over the summer. And he's like, I really struggle with like withholding like sacrament from people struggling with porn. He's like, this might sound weird, but we all struggle with something. Why is their struggle different than mine? Why would I put a barrier between them and renewing their covenants when they may need that more than other people? And I know bishops have different views on that. And so I'm like, oh, I'm so happy.
So awesome.
When people are struggling with porn, they actually do better when they're going to the temple. And it's like, yeah, keep doing the things that bring the spirit in your life. Keep renewing your covenants. Keep doing things that are meaningful. But the challenge is if someone's struggling with sexual concerns, often we further remove opportunities for connection for them and ways to fill the spirit. And I think those individuals probably need more of those opportunities. And I think that's church leader specific. I don't know if there's a standard protocol for that. But I've seen firsthand that church leaders that say, yeah, come chat with me. I'm here. I support you. I care about you. Let's keep working. Keep doing your thing. Keep reading. Keep praying. Those individuals tend to do better than those that say, we're going to restrict access to different things for you. I've seen that pretty consistently, that temple is helpful, taking the sacraments pretty helpful. But yeah, that's a challenge because mediating that is difficult.
Such a fine line, right? It's such a fine line. And obviously I'm no judge in Israel. I won't even pretend to go there, but I can see what you're saying. When they have access to the Savior, when they're going to the temple, like, of course they're going to feel better. Of course, when we feel the Spirit and we feel better about ourselves, we're going to curtail those patterns of behavior that we don't want, right? Because we feel better. We're more in alignment with who we want to be. We're more in alignment with who Christ wants us to be when we're continuing on that path of connection with Him.
Yep, and for me, that's the treatment, and that's the foundation of acceptance and commitment therapy. Instead of trying to control urges, we're going to actually focus more time on what are your values and are you living them? Are you living the life that you want to be? And most people don't probably want to live the I'm a porn addict life, and yet they spend most of their time and energy on that life. Mm-hmm. set that down and say, focus on living your values and building your connection with God or your family and pursuing your interests and education and career. The more you're in your life, the less you have a need to soothe yourself because of all these painful emotions through porn. And those things kind of settle down as you're living your life. That's a really different approach than addiction. That's saying, we got to fix this first and then you can live. Act is saying, live, and that's going to kind of take care of itself. And that is so liberating, and why it can be so effective quickly is people kind of know the life they want and feel like they don't have access to it or they don't have a right to it. And it's like, let's actually start living your life more. And it really helps.
Love that. Yeah, I love it. Well, I think we can wrap it up here. So many good things. I want to just quickly, like a just kind of a cap of what we're saying. I think in the addiction model, we're like, let's change these behaviors. Let's do different things as far as my patterns of behavior. And the reason that doesn't work, if we don't change who we are first, the way we're thinking and feeling, it's that willpower is in short supply. We can probably do it for a day, or maybe 2 days, or a week, maybe even a month, right? Yep. But if we're white knuckling consistently and we're just relying on that willpower and we never change the root, address what's at the core of the problem, and we just keep dealing with these surface level symptoms, long term, we are a slave to those patterns, right? Because we're always just holding on tight, trying not to go back there. But when we can change our thoughts and feelings about ourselves and about pornography in general and really start to change inside, I think it sort of organically produces a different result. And that's the path of less resistance, as far as I can tell.
Absolutely. And I've walked that path so many times with people with pornography, where it's like, I know the way out. And it's so helpful, and it works that way so well. So I've been glad I found an approach like ACT that's consistent with agency and consistent with kind of Latter-day Saint teachings. It fits it really, really well. And you do have to change those things from within it and grow that part of you that's been dormant, that we've neglected for a long time as we continue to avoid it. And what I want people to know is that's possible. There is so much hope. This is changeable. Even though you may have been struggling for years, decades, it's like, yeah, let's try a different approach, and you will probably get different results.
Love it. So if the addiction model has worked for you, beautiful, great. We're so happy for you. No naysaying about that. But if it hasn't and you're still struggling, there are some different ways. And so, again, I'm going to leave the link to your website in the podcast description. So if anybody wants to go check that out, they can. I have two final thoughts, and I'm going to ask you if you have any. Number one, if you're struggling, we want you to know that there's help and there are different ways to approach this. You're not broken and defective. In fact, your brain is working exactly as it should, right? Sexual desire is normal. And when you've been exposed to that as a child or wherever, and you've seen those images, it's like the concentrated version of sexual desire. And so your brain is seeking more dopamine. That's normal. Your brain is working exactly as it should. But there is help, and there are ways to combat that. Number two, if you're a woman or a young woman out there struggling with pornography, you are not alone. We love you. And your brain is also working exactly as it should. There's nothing wrong with you. What would you say to wrap this up? Final thoughts.
Yeah, everything you say is just so consistent with my experience and my thoughts. That's really refreshing and validating to hear that from your experience. I do just want people to know that this is so human. I think mortality and life is challenging. We're kind of thrown in here doing our best, figuring things out. There's so many trials and obstacles we face. And I think we're trying to find ways to cope with it the best that we can. Mm-hmm. And what happens is a lot of us find coping strategies that kind of help temporarily or kind of primitive, things we picked up when we're young. Like a lot of folks who struggle with porn, they started viewing when they were 8 to 12. And if you think about carrying on coping strategies that you picked up when you're a kid and thinking they're going to be sufficient for the things that we struggle with throughout the decades and through having children and having career and going through college and all of those kind of things, those coping strategies are inefficient. They're not going to work. I mean, there's other ways. So just because you're using maybe an outdated coping strategy like pornography, there's other things that we can use that are going to be more helpful for you. And they're not like really difficult to employ. So like mindfulness, getting more awareness of your thoughts and emotions, it may be challenging at first, but what I find is that not only helps you address the emotional need, but it's quite settling too. There's no like negative after effects like porn where you feel more guilt and shame. Engaging in emotional awareness and mindfulness helps you address those needs and feel good, help you live your life even better. So we can let go of unhelpful coping strategies like pornography. There's more effective ones out there. And I think just dropping the fear around pornography, maybe loosening up on addiction language, can give you enough room to navigate and try some things that could be new. And they're very accessible. This doesn't have to be years and years of really hard work. It's actually, let's focus more on doing some things that are meaningful to you in your life, that are naturally reinforcing. That way, that treatment approach doesn't have to be as painful as the let's keep fighting things that can't change. Instead, let's live a way that makes sense to you, that's consistent with your values, and that there's hope. I've seen that so many times with people. This does not have to be a forever issue, but people can move past this and get on with their life after pornography.
Love it. I think we can wrap up with that. You can move past it. You can get on with your life. You can overcome the struggles that you're having right now. Thank you. Thank you so much, Cameron. Appreciate your time. I know those who are listening, it makes all the difference to hear these messages of empowerment.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed hearing your counsel and learning from you too. This has been wonderful.
Absolutely. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed that interview. I think it's full of valuable information that we need to share with everyone. If the way we taught this process of allowing the emotions to help control behaviors resonated with you, please check out my other episodes on the podcast. I teach how to use this same skill in so many areas of your life and relationship. And make sure you go to my website, rhondafarr.com, to take advantage of all the free offerings I have that you can learn from and improve your intimacy every day.